podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke. With me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We're covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or is it Australia? And the current series we're covering is the 2013 Ashes.
Yes. The way this podcast works is for each Ridiculous Ashes series, we go through the test one by one and highlight the ridiculous moments delivered by each side. Dan nominates Australia's, I nominate England's. We then award 3-2-1 points for our top three moments, and most points wins that test match.
Yep.
The first test ended in a draw after our deadlock positions on Ashton Agar's 98 and Stuart Broad's refusal to walk were broken by Pat Actual Cummins, who came in and gave me a bit of stick, actually. He went for Agar, but then Jonathan Trott's Golden Duck and associated DRS shenanigans snatched a draw for the home team. So we're now moving into the second test. What happened? What actually happened in the second test, Dan?
All right, so the second test was at Lord's, and Alastair Cook elected to bat first. He won the toss, and he might have regretted his decision a little bit because Ryan Harris, who'd been recalled to the side in place of Mitchell Starc, he and Shane Watson combined to dismiss England's top order. They were 28 for 3, but runs from the middle order, including another century to Ian Bell, and of course, inevitable hefty 10th wicket partnership, saw England finish on 361 all out. Harris finished with 5 for 72, Steve Smith an improbable 3 for 18. In reply, Australia just were hopeless. They were all out for 128. Graham Swan did all the damage. He took 5 for 44. Cook could have enforced the follow-on, but he decided not to. Instead, he decided that the top three would again collapse. They were swiftly 30 for 3 because Peter Siddle had everybody playing on. But any slim chance of an Australian fight back was emphatically snuffed out by Joe Root, who scored 180 runs as England eventually gave themselves the better part of 2 days to bowl Australia out. As it turned out, they just needed the 1 day. There were half centuries to Michael Clarke and Usman Khawaja, but that wasn't enough. Australia were bowled out for 235 in the last over of the fourth day, giving England a 347-run victory and a 1-0 Ashes lead. So, do you want me to start with the first nomination here? Because I think I've got a pretty good one first up.
Yeah, I think I'm finishing at the very, very end of the match. So I think mine makes sense as the very final nomination. So you go first.
All right. So my first nomination is Chris Rogers and Shane Watson's review swap. So we did have a lot of nonsense in the first test with reviews, and the nonsense continues into the second test. As we mentioned, Australia batted second. England set a decent target for them. It started off perfectly well with the two openers, Chris Rogers and Shane Watson. Watto did, you know, multiple big booming cover drives that were just spectacular, racing away to the boundary. And then, of course, inevitably, he was hit on the pad and given out. And being Watto, he desperately wanted to review. And he managed to convince somehow Chris Rogers to let him review, despite the fact he seemed very, very plumb indeed. The huddled England team were watching this. They were egging Watto on to review. And eventually, he couldn't resist. He decided to make the big tee and sent it upstairs, and he was of course still out and trundled off with a review taken with him. So it was very exciting stuff.
This is the sort of very, very heart of the Watson LBW and wasting a review legend, isn't it? This is really where it's been formed in 2013, I think. He's already got a reputation for it. We can see because the England players are all goading him in the background.
That's very funny.
There's a sense of inevitability about it, but this is really when it's driving it home to everybody else that this is a thing that Shane Watson is unavoidably going to do. And the delight when he then does exactly that, when it just cannons into that gigantic front pad.
Yep.
And he refuses to believe it.
Yes. And it's such kind of a seminal moment in his LBW review career that it inspired a kind of infamous YouTube rant from a young up-and-coming cricket journalist by the name of Jeff Lemon, the unlikely name of Jeff Lemon. Jeff channeled all of Australia's frustrations with Watson's reviews into an infamous video called "Hey Watson!" And this went very viral as Jeff gave Shane quite the dressing down about how he should be saving reviews for teammates and not just reviewing because he would quite like to stay in. It was very entertaining, well worth looking up if you've got a few minutes on YouTube. It will almost certainly be in the show notes. So feel free to click on that and have a look at that one.
And the thing about this that struck me was that footage of Jeff's rant is what's insane is clearly so infuriating to Australians, and basically by this point his tendency to be out LBW and review is basically a joke, so everyone's just enraged with Shane Watson, and his was easily the best innings for Australia.
Yes, he top scored, he played the best shots by a long way, and and everybody else barely scored anything, but just the way the method of his departure was enough to enrage pretty much every single Australian back at home and negate all the good work he'd been done.
And he bowled well too.
He did, yes. But perhaps he was made aware of Jeff's rant, because when he was LBW again in the second innings, which he inevitably was, he resisted the review. Baby steps forward.
That was a nice moment, because then it introduced a sort of willy won't he tension to proceedings, which had never been present before, because previously it was just how long is it going to take Shane Watson to make the review signal.
Yes, but of course saving a review in the second innings didn't really help the first innings, because kind of one of the byproducts of his first innings review was that Chris Rogers, who'd kind of begrudgingly given the go ahead for him to do it, he was given out to a terrible LBW shortly after, and he, because they're already one review had been burnt, he didn't feel confident in sending this one upstairs, even though he should have, and clearly very, very badly wanted to. And in the end, he just kind of shrugged and headed off the ground and without saving himself. So that's my nomination. A wonderfully ridiculous swap of reviews from the Australian Open, as the one who shouldn't have used it did, and the one who shouldn't have used it didn't. And pretty much everybody watching knew they'd got it the wrong way around almost immediately.
There's a lovely symmetry. I don't know if it's symmetry or asymmetry to that. Whether you review or don't review, just be wrong. As long as the important thing is that you're wrong about it.
Yep.
Well, that leads into my first nomination, which is that Chris Rogers LBW. Graham Swan getting Chris Rogers LBW, which I think is a robustly ridiculous moment. We'll describe the actual delivery. So Swan bowled this looping full toss. You will have seen it, you might have forgotten it. Swan bowled this looping full toss. It would have been a beamer if it hadn't been so incredibly slow. Rogers went to pull/hook it, missed, and it hit him somewhere around the waistband, and Moraes Erasmus gave it out. And as you said, Rogers decided against reviewing it, but replay showed it was missing legs, so we got awful bowling, really, like, god-awful bowling, terrible batting, laughably bad batting.
Yeah, it was a slow full toss, essentially. Yeah. He could have hit it anywhere.
And bad umpiring, and bad reviewing as well, for that matter. And also, when he was asked if it was worth reviewing, Usman Khawaja just shrugged, so awful teammating.
Yes,
well.
Exactly. Terrible, terrible teammating from Usman.
It was a delightful moment all round. I particularly like the shot, because Rogers, he swung so hard, his helmet lollops about with the effort, and his hand comes off the bat. You know, just the sheer force of, like, this is just something that is just begging to be slammed to the boundary.
Yeah.
And then didn't even, like, get a edge on it or anything. I mean, on the basis of that and Khawaja's contributions, you could argue this was an Australian moment. But I'm saying without Swan, this can't happen.
Well, Swan's the initiator of the nonsense,
he's
isn't he?
The instigator, yeah. Yes. And it's an almost uniquely awful delivery. Swan himself was quite proud of it. At the close of play, I've got a quote from him. I'm not sure there's been a worse piece of cricket in Test history. I'm delighted to be at the centre of that. I'm sure he was as embarrassed about it as I was. And he said it just slipped out of his hand, and it did well to be going anywhere near the wicket. Not that near. He wasn't going to hit them.
No. You know? that's kind of broad, like, trolling there of the Australians there. So I think I may have underestimated Swan's ability to troll the Australians there, because that's a great piece of quotage.
Yeah.
I did say at the time that this series had highlighted the Australian batter's weakness against the swinging, seaming, spinning, undeviating or full toss ball. And I think that kind of summarises that last.
I often make this point about part-time bowlers, like real true part-time bowlers, the ones who are shit.
Yep.
I play squash a fair bit, and it's a it's a sport where every now and again, if you and the person you're playing against, both you're both in good form and you're seeing the ball well, you get into a real rhythm with it. And it's quite hard to see how a rally's going to end because, you know, the ball's always coming back off the back wall and you're just middling everything and everything's coming off the middle of the racket and there's no problems at all. And the way that they always end is that eventually one or other of you completely mishits it and it loops. It loops into the middle of the wall and it's slow and it's easy and the other person comes in to slam it and they just batter it into the tin or out of the court or something. That's where it goes wrong because your timing is just completely thrown. You're so used to the rhythm of it coming at a certain speed, like fast as well. I mean, a squash ball moves probably faster than a cricket ball and I'm not like some professional sportsman and I can get into the rhythm of it. So these guys, you do this for a living.
Yep.
They get into the rhythm of it as well with the bowling. And then when Graham Swan bowls one above your head that then drops down towards your balls, it's a pretty hard one to lay a bat on, as Chris Rogers proved.
All right, moving on to my next nomination. I've got "That decision sucked ass, hashtag bullshit." which is a kind of infamous tweet which came about in the following circumstances. So we're in England's second innings now. England are looking to extend their lead. Ian Bell, he's 3 at the time. He's just arrived at the crease to join Joe Root. And he's caught in gully by Steve Smith. Or was he? Because Ian Bell stood his ground. The ball was taken a bit too low for his immediate tendency to just go off. So the umpires sent it upstairs. And both Mark Nicholas and Michael Vaughan on commentary, they were quite convinced it carried, you know, fingers underneath it, all that usual stuff. 3D vision, foreshortening explanations, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a classic example of that thing, isn't it? Which anyone who's watched any sort of live cricket and seen a low catch knows this conversation inside out.
So they were quite convinced that Steve Smith had caught it. All the Australians were convinced, of course. Possibly even Bell was convinced, but he's savvy enough to know that it's dubious, and rightly so, because the third umpire came back and said, no, that's not out. It bounced before it went into Smith's hands, which is a little bit unlucky for Australia, who at the time, after just 2 tests, had discovered that catches taken at slip and gully were both not going to count in this series. But regardless, I mean, the catch itself isn't the nomination. The response to the catch is that shortly after this was overruled, a tweet appeared on the official Cricket Australia Twitter account: "That decision sucked ass, hashtag bullshit." And the tweet was... soon deleted, of course, but it was screenshotted for posterity, so you can always just Google it and get it. Of course, be careful to spell ass, A-S-S, not A-R-S-E, which is perhaps the more traditional Australian spelling. But after it was deleted, an apology went up on the Cricket Australia Twitter account. "Apologies for the inappropriate tweet earlier regarding the Bell catch. It didn't emanate from CA's official Twitter presence at Lords. CA is currently investigating the matter." So that was good news. And then a few days later, the investigation came to a close. "Cricket Australia, (CA), has been unable to identify the source of the offensive tweet posted to its official account during the course of the second Ashes test at Lords last weekend." And that's pretty much where the case was closed.
Again, this is like a symptom of the era, like of the sort of the early days of a form of technology. Like,
yes.
There's this fairly early days of DRS, and you can see people misusing it, and it comes across in a different way to how we see it these days. And I think it's the same with social media accounts, that that they were taking them, like the cricket bodies were taking them sort of semi-seriously, and that they were started to use them. They understood that they were now supposed to be using them, but I think they were still having the young lad just giving him the keys to the castle and letting him tweet whatever he wants. They hadn't yet sort of accepted that this was the official mouthpiece of their organization. It was kind of like this unofficial thing in their minds. And I think this was how they realized things like "that decision sucked ash, hashtag bullshit." They're thinking, maybe our official channel shouldn't be saying things like that about a live match.
Yes.
Or any match.
Yeah, so that was all very dramatic, and of course it inspired great mirth and great laughter over Cricket Australia's unprofessionalism. And it was eventually revealed a few years later, Brad Haddin finally retired after tormenting England bowlers for long enough. And in his retirement, he went on Instagram and he revealed that he, in fact, was the person responsible for this particular tweet. So he claimed that while the media manager had gone to the toilet, Brad Haddin had snuck onto his laptop and tweeted it out. And the media manager had still been in the toilet when he got a call from somebody back in Australia, some board member, saying, "What the hell's going on? Why are you tweeting this?" And he came out and he was furious and he said, like, who did this? Who did this? And Haddon, it turned out, blamed it on Shane Watson, which meant that Shane Watson got his second strike from Cricket Australia after the homework gate thing. So he was on very thin ice with poor old Shane Watson. And, of course, given the kind of tension between Watson and Clark, which I'm not sure we've got into yet here, Watson suspected that, in fact, it wasn't Haddon who did it. He suspected that Clark was trying to frame him. So it's a wild, wild thing to happen.
Yeah, because just before, was it just for this test match or just for this series, there were these legal documents came out about Mickey Arthur's ludicrous $4 million Australian dollar compensation claim against Cricket Australia. He was a previous coach. And these documents revealed that, you know, shock, Michael Clark and Shane Watson basically hated each other, which yes. I think was maybe not the revelation that was it, the way it was reported. It was like this astonishing thing, but I think everyone had a suspicion that was maybe the case.
But it was in writing now, in like a legal, it had been filed legally.
Yeah, that's true, in legalese. And Haddon's story kind of plays into that, doesn't it? I'm sorry, which I didn't know until you told me.
Yes. And here's kind of the most interesting thing about the Haddon story is that I'm not 100% sure I believe it's true. In fact, I'm very close to 0% sure I believe it's true, because Haddon was on the field when the catch was denied, and I kind of backtraced this, did some forensic analysis to see if I could work out what exactly happened. So the catch took place after drinks in the middle session of the third day. So the first opportunity Haddon would have had at the laptop would have been at the tea break. And while it's a little bit hazy in my memory as to when exactly the infamous tweet took place, you can, as I mentioned before, Google it, and the kind of most prominent screenshot you'll get from it puts it at 12:10 a.m., which is presumably the local time of whoever took the screenshot, because, I mean, it's certainly not local time at the game. So if that's Sydney-Melbourne time, that's half an hour before tea, which is probably the right time frame. That's shortly after the catch would have happened. Now, it's technically conceivable that it's a South Australian time zone, which would have put the tweet at, like, the very stroke of tea, like the exact moment that tea began. But that would have also meant that the Australians would have had to sprint off the field and be up and hacking a laptop within 60 seconds of the session ending. And that assumes the session didn't go, you know, a minute longer than scheduled. So I just, it's really weird. I don't think there's any way that Haddon could have done this. So I may be missing something obvious, but I think Haddon's just made this up, this story.
No, I mean, the other thing is, it also seems like any kind of reference to that decision would surely have been posted in the moment.
Yes.
Because otherwise, you, unless it's an example of that social media trend of referring to that catch or that yes. shot, yes. in the assumption that everyone will immediately know which one you're about. And I pretty much never do.
I'm not even sure that social media thing had been invented in 2013.
That social media thing.
Yes.
That social media thing which drives you crazy had not been invented yet.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not exactly sure. So exactly what happened there, but I'm certainly not convinced that Haddon was the one who posted it.
I don't know. I think Brad Haddon's a stand-up guy. I believe him. I believe him, despite all the holes in his made-up anecdote.
Yes. I mean, maybe Haddon's covering for the social media manager guy. Maybe he's heroically covering for him. But this, of course, wasn't the only Twitter controversy associated with this test, because we also had the emergence of a fantastic new character on the social media scene for the Ashes. This is David Warner's brother, @WarnDog79. So @WarnDog declared just before the test began that his brother was, quote, an escape goat for the root punching that saw him suspended. So this was very good news. But as the test went on, and particularly after the aforementioned infuriating Watson review, WarnDog79 also came out and tweeted, "Fucking selfish Watson, sooner you're out if the side, you great pretender, the better." So he's also not a big Watson fan. And then a little bit later, a tweet from the same account addressed to @CricketAustralia. "I hope you have a business class seat booked from SA to London, because it's about time you had a batsman there who will have a go." So there you go. WarnDog, as it turned out, denied he tweeted either of those last two tweets about referring to Shane Watson. He claimed he'd been hacked and presumably hacked by Brad Haddon.
So, who's hacking WarnDog?
That's my nomination, the wild Twitter sphere of Cricket Australia and associated entities.
That is that's a rich nomination. And, I don't know, emblematic of the time, I think. It's lovely. Right, my next nomination is day 3
Day three was definitely England's day, so you're more than welcome to nominate it.
Yes. I mean, it's England's test, but it was greatly centred on day three, so I'll try and contextualise it. So on day two, 16 wickets had fallen. On day three, 2 wickets fell. And then on day four, 12 wickets fell. So it was a little island of batting in a sort of sea of wickets. Unsurprisingly, it was Joe Root who halted the avalanche. Rather less predictably, did so with Tim Bresnan, who my mum always insisted on calling Bresnan as if he was a Soviet politician. It was Root's first century at Lords, and he went on to make 180. Bresnan batted for 3 hours for 38 runs, so it was very solid.
I like that Bresnan is joining our previous series, Katish. Bresnan and Katish sound like they could hammer out some peace treaties together.
These are things that once you hear them once, they're hard to unhear.
Yes.
And then Ian Bell, when Bresnan was out, Ian Bell came in and he made 74. So England finished the day 567 ahead, still batting.
Yes. I particularly enjoyed that in the first innings, Harris got Bresnan first ball of day two caught behind. And at that moment, Jeff Boycott on commentary said, "We really shouldn't be surprised at Bresnan being out for seven. We keep talking about him being able to bat." You'll be thankful that I'm not doing the accent here. "We keep talking about him being able to bat, but he never makes any runs for England." And then he immediately goes on to make 38 in the second innings as a night watchman, which pretty much makes the comment from Boycott an almost immediate hindsight corner.
Yeah, but I mean, like, batted half the day, I think, is probably more the contribution. Yeah. Like, just that was unexpected. So, like, the highlights of the day are just sort of boundaries, basically. And one of the sort of great supporting moment from the highlights, which struck me, was that I think it's a bit later on, Bell or Root hits one out to the boundary, and there's a diving boundary fielder, I think it's Usman Khawaja, who suffers the indignity of as he's diving, the ball bounces off the boundary Toblerone into his head and back up the boundary. It's just like all these low moments where you're already diving forlornly and failing to save a four. It's just sort of insulin to injury to have the ball like cannon off your back of your head.
Yeah, there were a lot of instances of Australian fielders running around the boundary edge and diving forlornly as a ball went in over the edge for four. Only one, I think, where it bounced off the fielder's head. So good work to Khawaja. I guess the other kind of highlight of this Root innings in particular was that this 180 formed the basis of what is now known as Root Maths. Because this was the series where everybody kept saying, if you ignore the 180, Root's had a terrible series. The term Root Maths was coined by Dave Tickner, a friend of the podcast.
I was going to say it was Dave, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And he went on to explain it a little bit later. So I'll give the definition of Root Maths here. Basically, specifically, Root Maths is the exclusion of inconvenient high scores from an average when wanting to point out a batsman is in fact shit, actually. More generally, it refers to any piece of statistical chicanery designed purely to manipulate the stats to say what you want them to say. So this is kind of the birth of Root Maths.
Yeah. I mean, it was a longer term phenomenon. It's an eternal phenomenon, really, but this was when it got branded, which is when Dave branded it, because this was like a really pure example of it.
Yes. And I guess the only other moment that I kind of doesn't actually take place on day three, because Root was batting so well, England batted on into day four despite being 500 and whatever they were ahead, and Root was dismissed early on day four, and this is where Shane Warne on commentary said he would have told Smith to drop the catch to keep Root out there and delay the declaration as long as possible, which is very Warne, I think.
Would he have told him as the ball was in the air?
I assume so. Or yeah.
Would have warned everybody beforehand? Because that's the only way you can realistically do it. You will say it to everybody. Yeah. Just don't dismiss Root, whatever you do.
Yes, but of course, as soon as Root was out, as soon as Steve Smith took the catch, maybe Smith didn't think it would count because he took it in gully. But anyway. But as soon as Root was dismissed, Alastair Cook called them in and set Australia 583 to win.
A mere 583 in 2 days.
Which brings me to my nomination, my final nomination, which is Australia not playing shots. So Australia, as I mentioned, had 583 to win, or more realistically, 2 days to bat out, only marginally more realistically. And either way, they decided that they would approach this challenge by not playing any shots at all. So we had several wickets to batters not playing shots. We had Rogers, who followed up, was dismissed by Swan again, this time not to a full toss. This time it was an arm ball from Swan, which Rogers just raised his bat towards and watched as it hit his off stump and he was out.
I can only presume that he'd concluded that trying to hit Swan was undignified.
Yes.
The state he'd left himself in the first innings, he thought, far better to just hope that it doesn't hit my stump. Just cross my fingers.
Can only lead to embarrassment trying to hit him, so yeah. I'll take the unembarrassing option of letting the ball go and hit the stumps.
This is a neat way of sidestepping embarrassment. So I'll just raise my bat and watch the nails come off.
Yes. A little bit later, we had Brad Haddon, of course. He also left one from Swan, which hit him on the pad right in front. There was no shot, he was fired out almost immediately. And again, I don't like quoting the commentators too often, but there's a great piece of commentary here from Boycott again. Boycott says, "Oh, that could be out. There's no shot. I think that's got to be out. I don't think there's any point in reviewing that, even if they could, which they can't, because they've no reviews left." Which summed up Australia's series so far. And of course, Hawkeye shows it would have turned past leg stump. So that was very, very perfect for the Haddon dismissal, no shot.
Kind of sums up the series so far as well. Australia wasting reviews, terrible dismissals, and terrible decisions all around.
Yeah, I think the reviews in the second innings were wasted by Phil Hughes and Steve Smith, who made one apiece. And
it was just the novelty of having access to them, probably.
I think so, yes.
It was totally a new experience for them.
They got carried away, the youngsters.
Yeah.
And then finally, Peter Siddle decided he quite also liked this not playing a shot stuff. So he also didn't play a shot to one of Broad's deliveries. Broad appealed for it because it hit him on the pad just outside of stump. It wasn't the full Broad celebre appeal, though. But it was enough to get Alistair Cook to review, and it was not out on umpire's call. So one of the non-shots going Australia's way on that application.
Okay.
So that's my third nomination.
Right. I don't think I have anything to add to that, but this is sort of off the back of that. My final nomination is the last two Australian wickets of the match. And I like this because it's such a familiar test match thing. If you watch the sport live, or if you go to the ground for a day and you happen to catch this kind of an innings. But it's something you don't really get a sense of in the highlights or in retrospect at all. So again, I've got to put it in context. So England took the first 18 Australian wickets in this match in 115 overs. So Australia were not batting amazingly well in this.
Yeah, so that's a little over 6 overs a wicket.
Yes, not much more than 6 overs per wicket. Then, when the match was basically over, they took 28 overs to take the last two. So Australia were 162 for 8, chasing 583 to win, with more than a day's play to go. And we all got to spend 2 hours watching Peter Siddle, James Pattinson, and Ryan Harris bat. So just the three worst batsmen in the the three worst batsmen in the losing team batting for 2 hours for no real effect.
I particularly like that at 9 down, England were able to claim the extra half hour, which was technically an extra 8 overs. Mark Nicholas was very emphatic about that. It's not an extra half hour, it's an extra 8 overs. And they took almost the full 8 overs to get the last wicket. Pattinson wasn't out until the very final over. And he was very annoyed about it was James Pattinson. He thought he'd been given out caught behind, and he was very adamant that he hadn't hit it, but he was in fact out LBW, so and he was very LBW, so
that's a good cricket thing as well, being correctly annoyed about a bad decision but incorrectly comprehending how you're out. It's good effort. Yes. There, and the other thing is the extra 8 overs, that way of extending purgatory, because it's just, it's not happening, and you think, well, at least it'll be the end of the day, come back tomorrow, and then they go, no, we're going to play some more. I think that it's presumably a lot of militaries do this, but I know the British military do a thing when they're training and they tell recruits, right, you got to run 5 miles or something, and then it's to do with expectations and the mentality of it. So when they arrive after five miles and they're sort of on their last legs, they say, you've got to run 5 miles more, and then they keep doing this, and you never really know when it's going to end. And it's not so much, well, it's partly about the physicality of it, but it's mostly about just having the ability to cope with that situation and the fact that you just don't know when this horror is ever going to end. And that's kind of how it feels with England trying to win a test match against Australia with just a couple of wickets to go. And just, I mean, particularly in this series where, the previous match, we've got a history of the last wicket lasting, hanging around a while. So,
yes.
Yeah, that was definitely in everyone's mind as they're watching it, just pleading for it all to be over.
The other thing I particularly liked about how annoyed Pattinson was to be given out in the final over of the day was, if he'd taken a moment to think about it, he didn't want to come back for the final day. What were they going to do? They were going to last, at best, a handful of overs. Yeah. And even at Lords, it's not going to rain all day at Lords, surely.
Well,
I mean, it might, but I haven't checked the weather, but I don't think it did. Otherwise, this would have been even more infamous and more ridiculous. But I have always liked the idea that because you take the extra eight overs, theoretically, doesn't that mean there's only 82 overs to survive on the final day? I mean, it never comes into practice because if you're taking the eight overs, they're not going to bat out 82 the final day. But
that's true.
Yeah, I would like to see that sometime.
Yeah, eventually.
Mm. I also quite like at this point, as Pattinson was dismissed, he did have Australia's best batting average for the series.
Oh.
He was averaging 36, and Ashton Agar was the highest run scorer. So the two number 11s from the first test, they were Australia's best batters.
That's a nice start.
Yes. All right. Do we have any unnominated moments?
What have I got? Oh, Steve Smith took three wickets and scored three runs.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes.
I don't know when was the last time he took as many or more wickets than runs. It could have looked, but, it's not really that interesting. It's just the idea.
No.
Of it.
I did like that the start of the test was delayed because the Queen arrived late. She showed up and stuck around until England lost three wickets and then she was out of there. So good work from the Queen of Australia.
Yeah. And off the back of that, England 28 for three in the first innings, 30 for three in the second innings, and won by 347 runs.
That's very strange, isn't it? Your top order contributes not at all. Doesn't matter.
I was toying with nominating it, but I think it needed maybe another wicket in each inning, and that would have been.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things we were toying with nominating, I've got. I was very tempted to nominate Ashton Agar, who had quite a subtly good test in ridiculousness wise, because we all remember the 98 as top tier ridiculousness.
Yeah.
But this second test had kind of a lot of subtler nonsense in there.
More of an all round performance. This one.
It was. Yeah. He was a young, silly player who could have been anything had he not been discarded. And, of course, he was discarded after this test. So just a couple of highlights I've got here. At one point in England's first innings, he was chasing a ball to a boundary and dove after it. And it was still quite out of reach, so he basically had to crawl after it on his belly like a lizard trying to drag it in, which was very entertaining.
That's a high point.
Yes. When Australia batted, he managed to run himself out. He came three quarters of the way down the pitch before Brad Haddon sent him back, and he was out by a fair distance in that particular effort.
That was good. That was a real sort of giddy puppy quality, just like hairing off for a run, like in defiance of circumstance, and really like getting a long way towards it. And then, the about turn.
Yep. We also had in England's next innings, we had Agar dropped a pretty easy caught and bowled chance that just hit him in the chest. He didn't see it somehow, despite it being hit straight back to him. So that was nicely done. And then, of course, in the fourth innings, Agar batted again. He edged one behind. He was given not out. England reviewed it. And despite the fact there was no mark on hotspot, it was inexplicably given out. I have no explanation for why he was given out. He just was. They got the vibe. The third umpire had the vibe by now. And Agar seemed infinitely more upset by this than being caught for 98 in the previous test. So, yeah. I kind of regret I didn't nominate this one now. Agar, fine form from the young lad.
Yeah, good cumulative effort. Those are always my nominations. The cake and eat it, sticking five different things in one. But a minor point that I noticed, Jimmy Anderson in as night watchman for Stuart Broad, which I think that's probably a bit hindsight corner. Broad was still had a reputation as a batter and he batted well in the previous match, but I got nothing else to mention. Do you want to get into the votes?
Yes. All right. So I think I'm going to make a very strong case for that decision sucked ass as being the three-pointer here. It's definitely my strongest nomination. It's kind of ridiculous that it went out on an official account. It's even more ridiculous that nobody knows how it happened and kind of the one confession about it doesn't make any sense at all. But it still kind of implicates everybody as being part of this very strained and strange team culture. So, that's my nomination.
There's a lot hanging off that one. Sort of, ripples through the decades with Brad Haddon. I mean, possibly making up a story. Maybe it was fact. I like the everything wrong aspect of the Watto Rogers reviewing, but I think
it is very, very silly. Yeah,
I think Suktas is probably stronger. It's just, like I say, very symptomatic of the time when organizations started taking social media slightly more seriously, but not that seriously.
Not that seriously,
so
yeah.
I like it in that respect. I think the Swan's my best, easily.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I think my second best is Australia's last two wicket.
Yes.
Because it's such a familiar watching cricket live thing, just all 2 hours of pointless action. Yeah, my other one, day three, that's a bit of shit.
Yeah, and I'm not convinced by Australia not playing shots particularly great either. So
there's the four we're juggling with. Well, that decision sucked ass, or Swan's horrible.
Well, I think the decision sucking ass, it's more, I think it lives on longer. I think to this day, that still pops up on social media every now and then. It's kind of, remember when Cricket Australia did this? I'm not quite sure the horror ball emerges quite as regularly. I think the decision sucking ass has,
I think that's
stood the
one
test
where
of time.
It feels like we're so much less likely to see these days, whereas
yes.
A real, I mean, there's a lot sort of off the back of the Swan's terrible delivery as well, in the sense that it then just sort of snowballs from there. But
yes,
okay, I think I'm prepared to concede that decision success is as strong as the three pointer here.
I'm happy with the Swan terrible delivery, because as you said, every single person involved is doing something really, really ridiculously bad in that. The batter, the bowler, the umpire, the teammate, the non-striker, like everybody's just messed it up completely. So I think that's a solid two-pointer.
Okay, so we're pitting the Watto Rogers review. So Watto reviewing. It's one of these where sometimes I get a bit numb to it because it appears so often. But this is just such a perfect example of it.
It's such a perfect bad review because of the impact it had on Rogers, who knew that he couldn't review something he emphatically should have reviewed, because as we mentioned, it was ridiculously bad.
Yeah. This is really probably like the nadir of Watto's reviewing as well, really. Or the zenith. I don't know how we put it. I'm always tempted to make that 3 points, you know. I think I'm talking myself down. Yeah, I think your two are better than mine, I've decided.
So you're saying Watto Rogers 3, that decision sucked ass 2, and then Swan 1, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we're disagreeing maybe about the order of the first two, but I've talked myself out of like almost any points now. I'm giving myself 1 point.
All right, well, okay, let's go with that. I'm happy to, it launched the career of one of cricket's great modern day journalists in Jeff Lemon as well. Got him a bit of exposure. All right, let's go with that. A Watto review is never a bad thing to give 3 points to.
No. We've effectively given our points out and then altered our decision on review as well.
Yes. All right, so I think that gives Australia the second test. So Australia take a 1-0 lead in the ridiculous Ashes.
Curses. If only I'd thought to argue in my own favour.
Oh, maybe next time. We'll see what comes about in the third test in our next episode. But thank you for listening to this one. You can check out Alex's website. That's kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is liebcricket.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Ridiculous Ashes, or individually at The King's Tweets or at Lieb Cricket. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode and want to support us with actual money, you can find us both on Patreon, patreon.com/kingcricket for Alex, and I'm patreon.com/liebcricket. And we will be back in a week with our coverage of the third test of the 2013 Ridiculous Ashes. So subscribe to the podcast to listen to that. And of course, while you're doing that, you might as well give us your honest 5-star ratings on the podcast store of your choice. And we will see you then.
Thanks.
Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.